When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
This episode of Stuff You Should Know is sponsored by Squarespace. Whether you need a landing page, a beautiful gallery, a professional blog, or an online store, it's all possible with the Squarespace website. Go to squarespace.com and set your website apart.
Welcome to Stuff You Should Know from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh Clark. There's Charles W. Chuck Bryant. And Jerry's over there, and there's some coffee. I see a few posters. There's a Beasley brand storage thing.
You getting some of that Beasley cash coming your way?
Maybe.
What was that all about?
I hope it's Beasley. It could also be Beasley. I don't know.
You know, I got a listener mail from someone who went to get a bonsai tree in Boston. After they were inspired after our episode, and the dude, she's like, have you been busy? And the guy was like, this week we've been, like, people want bonsai trees, the phone's been off the hook.
No way.
Yeah, we could be getting some of that bonsai scratch.
We definitely should be.
We're getting nothing.
Japan should be giving us money,
man. What's their monetary unit?
The yen.
Is it still the yen?
The Japanese yen.
We need many yen coming our way.
Yeah,
soon.
Many yet. And they're going to try to flash some numbers at you. You'll be like, wow, that's a lot.
Yeah,
remember, it's about 100 yen to $1.
I'll let you negotiate that one.
I think it's 10 now.
Yeah.
I don't remember.
And the other night, I turned on the television and Karate Kid was on.
Oh, I saw that.
Just moments before the wonderful bonsai scene.
Yeah, I saw it. You took a picture of your television.
Yeah, and I put it on Instagram.
I saw. Our Instagram, SYSK Podcast.
Yeah, we're trying to take more pictures.
Yeah.
Isn't that what you do?
Share ourselves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But this isn't about bonsai.
No, I've got one more shout out though. There's a dude named Aaron Seitz who, remember when we had our horror fiction contest years back?
Sure.
And we said that anybody who, was a part of it, if they ever published anything, we give them a shout out.
In perpetuity.
In perpetuity. And Aaron Seitz, published something. He published a short story collection called The Andrew Jackson Stories.
Ooh.
And he says that it was published by Lockjaw Magazine, and he said they're about Andrew Jackson about as much as Richard Brautigan's Trout Fishing in America is about trout fishing.
That means nothing to me.
Well, it wasn't really about trout fishing. But it's a slim little book. He sent it to us. I haven't read it yet, but he swears up and down that it's awesome. So we're going to go ahead and take his word for it.
Right.
But congratulations, Aaron Seitz. And if you want to go get your hands on Andrew Jackson's stories, go look it up. Go to the Lockjaw Magazine site, I would imagine.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's done. And now we can talk about Controlled Burns.
Yes. Good band name. Controlled Burn?
Yeah, depending on, like, maybe if it was like a soft rock group.
Yeah, yeah, they're like a 80s wedding band, Controlled Burn.
Oh, sure.
Good evening, we are Controlled Burn, and this is by ELO.
Right. Or Loggins and Messina.
Yeah. I'm not dissing ELO, by the way. I love
ELO is great. Did you see Kenny Loggins on Documentary Now? The two-parter?
Yeah. Which episode was that?
It was the two-part one about the what was their thing?
I don't remember.
Oh, they were a band. They were
Oh, that's right. That was the band. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It was like the greatest band name ever.
It was good.
I want to say California Chrome, but that was that racehorse. I don't remember what they were called.
Was it Controlled Burn?
No. But that was a good one.
Yeah.
That two-parter.
Great show.
Love that show. And there's a new season coming out, right?
They should.
Okay. So, again, we're talking about controlled burning, not a ban, an actual thing.
Yeah, and this ties into our wildfires episode.
Yeah, which we did.
Mm-hmm. Years back.
Yeah. But Chuck, I always love the opportunity to talk about 1491.
Oh, here we go.
And here's one now.
All right.
So, it wasn't until about
1491, the book, by the way.
Right.
If you're new to the show.
Oh, yeah.
This is Josh's long, stated favorite book.
So long.
And, you've talked about it a lot.
At least 50, 60 times.
Yeah. And I would have read it by now if you hadn't have talked about it so much.
You don't even need to now. You know the whole book. So 1491, one of the premises of it is that they're like our understanding of, Native America in North and Meso and South America prior to Columbus coming over is like just totally wrong.
Yeah.
There were way more people. They were way more advanced than, anthropology and archaeology has long given them credit for.
Yeah. They had internet cafes.
Pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
They did. but it wasn't until like the early 2000s that this idea of the noble savage who treaded lightly on the ecosystem, on the environment started to crumble, right? And, we started to realize that a lot of the features, what the early explorers thought were natural features of North and South and Mesoamerica were, actually really well-managed ecosystems, right? And one of the ways that Native Americans used or managed ecosystems was through fire.
Yeah.
But again, there was this idea that Native Americans just had no idea what they were doing with anything. So whenever archaeologists up until about 2000, 2001 or two, the late 90s maybe, anytime they came across evidence of like a fire and it seemed like the Native Americans had set it, they just assumed that either the Native Americans had set it to amuse themselves.
Yeah, because they're big dummies.
Or because a campfire got out of control.
Because they're big dummies.
Right.
Boy, oh boy.
But this is what they came up with. They're like, oh, well, they clearly just wanted to set some fires for fun.
Right.
They couldn't have possibly had any point to it.
Sure.
But then more and more investigation has shown like, no, actually, not only did they know what they were doing, like, if you step back and look at North America, the whole continent was a managed set of ecosystems.
Yeah.
And one of the ways they did it was through fire. The other thing that interested me too was depending on the explorers and the Europeans and the settlers that came over to North America, some of them came and that was not anything new to them.
Yeah.
It turns out that using fire to manage ecosystems is almost universal.
Oh yeah.
Basically.
Yeah. I mean, some of the reasons they might have done it, of course these days, one of the main reasons we do it is to prevent forest fires from spreading,
right?
Which we'll get to. But back then, they would use it to improve the foraging conditions for free-ranging cattle.
Yeah,
increase visibility, access. There were all kinds of great reasons to burn things in a controlled way.
Yeah, supposedly the early explorers didn't really think about it, but the historians went back and looked at it. The explorers who used to say, like, you can't get through the forests in North America, we're talking about swampland, like lands that wouldn't burn.
Yeah.
But you could drive, like, a car through a forest in, like, Ohio or something like that.
Yeah.
Although there's swamps in Ohio, a non-swampy part of Ohio, because of the use of fire.
Are there swamps in Ohio?
Yeah, there were.
Wow.
They filled them in and built Toledo over it.
So, you were talking about the, when Europeans came upon the scene. It's really interesting. I read this article called, The Historical Foundations of Prescribed Burning for Wildlife, A Southeastern Perspective.
Beautiful.
By A. Sidney Johnson and Philip E. Hale. And it was, I think it was an academic paper or something, but it started to dawn on me when they were talking about the founding of America, why we ended up like we ended up. It just kind of all came together, for me.
Because, I love reading stuff like that. It like connects dots that weren't connected before.
And this was a simple dot I should have connected before. But basically, in the northeast of the United States, it was largely settled by people from the southern lowlands of England. People that lived in cities and people that had not, for the most part, lived on farms.
Right.
And didn't have a lot of experience with agriculture and certainly not with prescribed burning, which is another name for a controlled burn.
Right.
And then in the south, particularly the southeast, we were more populated by people from rural areas of the UK and Scotland and Ireland and Western England. Mm-hmm. They had a lot of experience with farming.
Right.
And then I started to think, oh, wait a minute, that all just makes total sense. That's why the Northeast became industrialized.
Right.
That's why the South were a bunch of yokels.
They were agrarian.
And it just sort of, it was a very obvious thing, but it just sort of like coalesced in my mind.
Yeah, no, I know
what
you mean.
Way.
I knew that part already, the industrialization aspects of it. But one of the things that coalesced for me was wondering how much of the Civil War was driven by...
Sure.
By rivalries that go back to England and Scotland and Ireland,
sure.
Rather than, you know, the context of North America and the U.S.
Absolutely, because I think for the most part, once people came over here, mm-hmm. they did things like they did them over
right.
there.
Yeah.
Which makes sense.
Like Scarlett O'Hara's father had that Irish brogue, remember?
No.
Yeah, her dad, I'm pretty sure he did, unless
really?
I'm losing my mind right
well,
now.
Well, it's been a while since I've seen that movie.
Huh. I'm pretty sure.
I believe it.
Okay.
But it makes sense, and like you said, maybe the attitudes came along with that.
Yeah.
Maybe that carried over into how people felt about each other pre-Civil War.
Yeah. I'll bet it did. But the point of all this is that up north, there was fire suppression. That was the key driver, right? Like they would try to keep fires from breaking out under any circumstances.
Yeah, and don't get confused, because a suppressing fire
right.
is a controlled burn. Fire right. suppression is putting out fires.
Yeah.
So maybe we should just say up north, they didn't think that starting fires on purpose was smart.
Yeah. They were like,
south,
no fires.
And down south, they said, no, this is, we've been doing it in England for years.
They were like, fire.
Yeah, fire is a good way to manage things.
Yeah. And that's how the nation was divided, at least at first. And then the Civil War happened. And interestingly, the Yankees came down and said, hey, this old plantation will make a really great hunting preserve.
Yeah.
And I'm going to buy it.
Yeah.
And now that I own this enormous tract of land in the South, I'm a Yankee, and we don't believe in fire, so I'm going to make sure no fire ever breaks out here, even though everybody's been using fire techniques for generations.
Yeah, and interestingly too, the fire techniques that the founders in the South used were the same kind that the Native Americans in that area used.
Right.
So like they were on the same page, thousands of miles apart.
Yeah.
And basically came and kind of started doing the same thing, or kept doing the same thing that Native Americans were doing.
And what makes that even more interesting is that it's using fire is not universal to ecosystems.
Right.
Like there's different techniques or not using it at all depending on the type of ecosystem you're dealing with.
Well, yeah, because in the southern lowlands, apparently the forests were like fire sensitive hardwoods and spruce trees. So mm-hmm. it sort of depended on what kind of forest you had.
Right.
I guess theirs weren't as flammable.
Right. Or inflammable, which is a word I think we should just get rid of entirely.
Inflammable?
Yeah. It means the same thing as flammable, but it sounds like it means the opposite. It's just a stupid word.
Really?
Yeah, inflammable.
I've never heard of it.
Well, that's great. That's all the more reason to get rid of it.
That's crazy.
Inflammable means flammable. What's the point?
Man, what a dumb language.
So, the point of the whole thing is that fire is a natural feature of a living, thriving ecosystem.
Yes.
It's something humans are terrified of, but on the environmental level, on the ecological level, it's a necessary component to keep any or most ecosystems healthy, right?
Yes.
And some groups of people understood this. The people who ended up running the show after the Civil War did not believe this. And it actually has had a very large impact throughout the 20th century in the United States, which we're just now overcoming.
Oh, yeah.
We can actually thank one guy for changing the attitude toward fires and using them for wildfire management. And we'll talk about him right after this. Stuff you should know. All right, game off. Let's pause here to talk more about Monopoly Go.
Because in Monopoly Go, you can team up with your friends for timed tournaments where you work together to build up each other's boards. It's very nice.
That's right. And the more you win together, the more awesome prizes you unlock. And there's so much to get. I'm talking about unique stickers that you can trade with friends to complete albums for big prizes, cool new playing pieces to travel the boards with, or hilarious emojis for taunting friends when you smash their buildings or heist their vaults.
Plus, Monopoly Go feels new and exciting every day with constantly changing tournaments and challenges, like digging for treasure or a robot pachinko machine. And there's always new timed events that help you win big, like massive multipliers for everything you win or rent frenzies.
That's right. There's always something fun to discover in Monopoly Go. So get off the bench and go download it now for free on Google Play or the App Store. Game on. Hey, everybody. Did you know that Boricua is the name for someone from Puerto Rico? But it's more than just a name. It's a way of life and representation of the vibrant spirit of the island.
Yeah, that's right. It's an island that's filled with adventure around every corner and natural treasures waiting to be explored, like El Yunque, the only tropical rainforest in the entire United States.
That's right. Or you can get swept away by natural beauty and come away with unique stories that could only be experienced in Puerto Rico that remind you of why you travel in the first place.
Visits end, but stories last forever. You don't become a part of the island, it becomes a part of you.
That's right. In Puerto Rico, you can forget where you came from and embrace where you are. No passport required for U.S. citizens and permanent residents. Learn more and plan your trip at discoverpuertorico.com.
All right, so you teased a name drop.
I did.
Right before the break. In 1923, well, there was this one particular northern landowner that came down south and bought up a bunch of plantations. His name was Henry Bedell, and he hated fire.
Fire had burned his favorite horse.
Maybe. You never know. So he hated fire. He was appalled at the idea of burning land. And but other people, you know, like we were saying in the south, said, no, it's a good thing. So in 1923... they commissioned the U.S. Bureau of Biological Survey, which was a precursor to the Fish and Wildlife Service. And, it was headed up at the time by a guy named Herbert L. Stoddard, who was the name that you teased.
Right. And Stoddard, actually, the thing that kicked it off the most was that these guys who bought these huge plantations and turned them into preserves, they like to hunt quail.
Yeah.
And, they noticed,
quail.
Right. And they noticed that the bobwhite quail population was declining every year and they had no idea why. So they brought Stoddard in and Stoddard became a bobwhite quail expert.
Well, he already was.
Oh, he was already. That's why they brought him in?
Yeah. He wrote a book about it. And, this guy was awesome. He helped found literally helped found a profession of wildlife management.
Right. The whole field is like basically this guy.
Yep. He wrote like some legendary books that are still used today. He was like literally the first critic of industrialized agriculture. He's just this sort of champion.
And a Georgian, a transplant to Georgia.
Yeah. Yeah. I think he's from Chicago, but did a lot of work here for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he starts looking into the quail situation down here and he's like, well,
you need to burn them.
There's your problem. You guys have a woody undergrowth problem. And
gross.
I looked into this and bobwhite quail require some of the most complex habitats you've ever heard of, right?
Yeah.
So they thrive in areas where you've got what's called woody cover, which are dense shrubbery.
Yeah.
That's like mostly woody,
mm-hmm,
that they can use as what's called covey headquarters.
Yeah.
It's like little escape patches, and they need them all over the place. But in addition to this, they also need food sources. So they need like crops of a certain variety. And then they also need some grassy areas. And they need all this stuff in certain proportions. And if you have the proportions right, which apparently they did, the quail populations thrive. But if you have too much of one thing, then the quail populations diminish. And that one thing that had grown up was the woody undergrowth. And the reason the woody undergrowth was allowed to grow up was because the Yankees came in and stopped using fire.
That's right.
Isn't that interesting?
I think
so.
Totally,
it was all because these rich guys, these rich industrialists,
yeah,
who wanted to hunt quail were like, where's all the quail?
Right.
And, they hired the government to come look into it. And this government guy came in and was like, oh, here's the problem. You guys need to set this on fire. But the thing is no one listened to him.
Well, no. He had a few people that, they hired him for his expertise, so he had a few people that got on board, but he fought for many, many years. Like the history of controlled burning, it wasn't until post-World War II is when it started to catch on a little bit. Uh-huh. And then in the 50s and 60s, it became more commonplace. But it wasn't until 1971 that the U.S. Forest Service had their very first symposium on prescribed burns. And that's what really turned the tide. But this was the 1920s, and it took all the way till the 1970s for it to become like completely accepted as the right way to do things.
Yeah. And in the meantime, we had a lot of unnecessary wildfires.
Well, and one of the reasons, too, was apparently all the forestry workers in the South were from the North. And so they had these bad experiences in England and elsewhere with, like, devastating fires that killed people and wiped out villages.
Right.
And apparently they also had this German influence, like a protectionist influence from Germans in forestry school. That was taught to them that way.
Gotcha.
So they were doing it all wrong.
Well, one of the other explanations I saw for why the Forestry Service was like, no, you can't burn down here, is because one of the spoils of winning the Civil War was the North came down and just clear cut the South of its pine, and they figured, well, the pine forests have been so devastated
for what, for timber?
Uh huh.
Yeah.
That we can't let any fire happen, or else no, this pine's never going to recover. So we really can't do any burning now.
Man.
Yeah. So eventually everybody started listening to Stoddard, and now we use fire pretty much everywhere in the United States. And there's a couple of reasons to set fires on purpose. And the coolest one is that if you set fires on purpose, you actually prevent wildfires down the line.
Yeah, and you know, we're not talking about, like, completely burning down every tree in the forest.
Well, yeah.
They're mainly burning the stuff that will catch everything on fire, like the understory, the underbrush, the dead leaves, dead branches, stuff on the ground.
Right. And if you burn that on purpose, you burn out the fuel for, a future out-of-control wildfire.
Yeah.
One of the other things you do is you open up the canopy, right?
Yeah.
So you're burning out some trees, but for the most part, the older, more established trees can survive. And since that canopy's opened up, more sunlight can come through. And when more sunlight can come through, you have smaller trees that can start to grow. So there's more reproduction, actually.
Yeah, and if you're listening thinking, well, this all sounds great, but doesn't that release a ton of carbon emissions in the air when you're burning things? Mm-hmm. And if you're burning thousands and tens of thousands of acres a year on purpose, aren't you just adding to the problem?
No.
I was being coy. Yeah. But the answer is no.
Well, it depends.
Well, so it's a little bit of both.
I thought this was a little strange for the way that this was parceled out. So on the one hand, in this article, it says, nope, actually, they've done studies and the large established trees that can survive a controlled burn actually lock in more carbon in the long run than so the controlled burn releases less than, say, a wildfire that's burning out of control that burns those trees and unlocks that carbon, right?
Yeah.
And then later on in the last, like, section of this article, the author's like, yeah, that really just depends on what kind of forest you're talking about. In some forests, it doesn't make a difference at all. And yes, then in that case, it's bad for the environment.
I don't know about that last part.
I'm just saying. I just think it was weird.
Well, I think it's cool, though, like what you just said, though, the large trees capture that carbon.
Right.
And if you burn off the small stuff underneath, what you said earlier, it's going to open up that canopy and let those big trees grow bigger.
Yeah.
And that's going to be good in the long run. Long-term gain for short-term carbon emission output.
Right. So, and then also, in addition to opening up that canopy, allowing more sunlight so reproduction can happen, there's actually, they found some species of trees that depend on fire to reproduce. And chief among them is the giant sequoia.
So beautiful trees.
In Yosemite, in I think the 60s, they were like, the sequoias aren't reproducing. What's going on? And somebody, a guy named Dr. Richard Hartsveld, said, I think it has to do with fire. We stopped doing fire, and we want to do fire. So let's do some fire. And they're like, shut up, Hartsveld. You can't even talk right.
Yeah.
And he's like, I'm going to go burn some stuff and prove you guys wrong. So he started doing some tests. He'd do fire tests. And he found that when fire was applied to a sequoia forest, the sequoia cones opened up and their seeds could germinate.
Yeah, and the big daddies are very fire resistant.
Yeah.
So they were like, I'm a little hot underneath in the undercarriage.
But it feels nice.
But it feels pretty good. And I'm going to stand strong. But what I'm going to do, like you said, is I'm going to open my cones. And the other thing it does is, you know, when you drop seeds, if you have a woody understory, and understory is another word for that underbrush.
Right.
Under, what'd you call it? Undercover? Undercoverage?
Woody cover for a bobwhite quail. That's what the bobwhite quails call it amongst themselves.
All right. So imagine a seed dropping from a pine cone from 100 feet up.
Right.
And the ground is covered in leaves and sticks and things. That seed might fall on a pile of leaves 6 inches deep and just sit there.
Just sit there and be like, I'm unfulfilled.
AKA, it never makes contact with the soil where it needs to be to establish roots.
Right. Or even if it did, the sunlight is being blocked out by the understory.
And fire solves all those problems.
It does, because fire pops that pine cone open. The seeds come out.
Yep.
They are in the newly burned ground, which has a lot of carbon fertilizer now in the form of ashes.
Sure.
And lots of sunlight coming through because the understory has been burned away. So fire's the greatest thing ever.
Pretty amazing.
But, again, we said before, it depends on the ecosystem, right? So especially out in California, they got kind of burn happy. They're like, oh, wait, fire can actually suppress wildfires? We have tons of wildfires out here. We need to burn all the time. And they started burning and burning and burning in Southern California, and it had zero impact on diminishing wildfires. And they couldn't figure out why. And they finally said, well, maybe we should study the ecosystem we're setting on fire and see what's what. And they found that they really shouldn't be burning the Southern California ecosystem to prevent wildfires. So that actually makes it worse in this case.
Yeah, in Southern California, they have what's called chaparral. And it's the, I mean, if you've ever been to Southern California, you know that it looks lovely now in the neighborhoods because people planted stuff everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
But the hillsides are kind of gross. They're brown and they're thorny and they're shrubby.
It's like all tumbleweeds.
Yeah, it's just, it's not. It's just sort of gross in those canyons.
Right.
And that's just my opinion.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, that's chaparral, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
And that chaparral, well, if you leave everything to itself there, apparently it's super fire resistant.
Right.
So every, like, if you left it naturally, it would only catch flame every 100 years or so.
Right. But they were setting fire to this every few years. In order to try to prevent wildfires. And what they were ultimately doing was burning the chaparral, which was naturally flame resistant, right?
Yeah.
And in favor of the chaparral, what was, since it took a long time to grow back, the stuff that was beating the chaparral out that could grow faster was actually very flammable.
Yeah.
So they were promoting the growth of wildfire fuel in Southern California by burning the chaparral too much.
Good stuff.
It is. It's really interesting.
All right. Well, let's take a break and we'll come back and talk about a little bit about climate change and how that factors in, and then how you can do your own controlled burn. Stuff you should
know. All right. Game off. Let's pause here to talk more about Monopoly Go. Because in Monopoly Go, you can team up with your friends for timed tournaments where you work together to build up each other's boards. It's very nice.
That's right. And the more you win together, the more awesome prizes you unlock. And there's so much to get. I'm talking about unique stickers that you can trade with friends to complete albums for big prizes, cool new playing pieces to travel the boards with, or hilarious emojis for taunting friends when you smash their buildings or heist their vaults.
Plus, Monopoly Go feels new and exciting every day with constantly changing tournaments and challenges, like digging for treasure or a robot pachinko machine. And there's always new timed events that help you win big, like massive multipliers for everything you win or rent frenzies.
That's right. There's always something fun to discover in Monopoly Go. So get off the bench and go download it now for free on Google Play or the App Store. Game on. Hey, everybody. Did you know that Boricua is the name for someone from Puerto Rico? But it's more than just a name. It's a way of life and representation of the vibrant spirit of the island.
Yeah, that's right. It's an island that's filled with adventure around every corner and natural treasures waiting to be explored, like El Yunque, the only tropical rainforest in the entire United States.
That's right. Or you can get swept away by natural beauty and come away with unique stories that could only be experienced in Puerto Rico that remind you of why you travel in the first place.
Visits end, but stories last forever. You don't become a part of the island, it becomes a part of you.
That's right. In Puerto Rico, you can forget where you came from and embrace where you are. No passport required for U.S. citizens and permanent residents. Learn more and plan your trip at discoverpuertorico.com.
All right, by the way, I was kidding. No one should try this ever, ever, ever.
We should have probably not broken for a minute or so before you said that.
I don't think anyone just paused and said, oh my gosh, I'm going to run out, because we didn't teach them yet.
Oh, that's a good point.
You should never start a fire.
Yeah, don't start fires.
Okay. Got that out of the way. Climate change is having an impact on these wildfires. From between 1979, there's a season, a fire, wildfire season.
Yeah.
We talked about it in our episode when it's just more likely to happen. And between 1979 and 2013, the global fire season increased by almost 19%.
Yeah, which means like the fire season grew longer around the world.
Yeah.
By that much.
Which is bad. And, at the rate of 864 million acres worldwide of wildfire that burn every year, which is an amazing number. Apparently that emits more than half the amount of carbon that fossil fuels put out in the atmosphere.
Yeah, so
it's awful.
That's a tremendous amount, right?
Yeah, and it's a feedback loop.
It is, because it contributes CO2 to the atmosphere, which promotes the greenhouse effect, right? The greenhouse effect creates drought conditions. It heats things up. It lowers humidity, and it becomes a vicious cycle, right? Because when you have drought conditions, you have more dead trees that provide more fuel for more wildfires, and the more wildfires put more CO2 into the air, which promotes the greenhouse effect, and it just gets worse and worse and worse.
More wind, too.
Yeah.
It's a big problem.
Yeah, I was reading about the Fort McMurray wildfire up in Canada, and apparently they just had some freak weather.
The Fred McMurray wildfire?
Yeah. Yeah. He was like... I got no Fred McMurray jokes. the city, Fort McMurray, like a little outside town, they think the fire started somewhere out there. They're not sure what did it yet, but they had some freak weather where it was like 91 degrees. They still have like frozen lakes up there right now, but the temperature was like 91 degrees.
Wow.
Humidity was at like 15% and winds were at about 45 miles an hour. So it was just ripe for a wildfire. And now it's up to like about 450,000 hectares.
Wow.
Which is exactly a ton of acres, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Man. All right. So how do you start a controlled burn? How do you do this?
Carefully.
Well, first of all, you want to work for the Forest Service or Fish and Game or...
Yeah, the author of this article says, go to local authorities. I'm like, you can do this if you're not a local authority?
Yeah.
But I guess you could. Like, he also mentions a landowner in the Pine Barrens of New Jersey.
Yeah, that does his own controlled burns.
Right.
Surely you have to get... You got permitted if you're doing it yourself.
Right. Well, yeah, he's saying go to local authorities, but I was surprised that you can do it if you're not a local authority.
Yeah, I didn't know that either.
Right.
In fact, I'm still not quite convinced.
At the very least, you want to collaborate closely with local authorities if you're not one.
That's right.
Okay.
This beginning stuff is, you know, get your permits, find out what the best time of year and all that stuff. What you need to do is just leave it to the people who do it best.
Right.
But this is what they're going to do. But the first thing that you want to do after you've gotten all your equipment and all that good stuff mm-hmm. is look at the weather and pick out a good time to do it.
Yeah, you want it kind of damp.
Sure.
You want the humidity above 25%.
Ideally.
Low winds.
Yeah.
Basically everything the opposite of the weather like it was in Fort McMurray on May 1st.
Yeah, less than 80 degrees,
mm-hmm.
Ideally. And then once you've got everything all set up and you've got a great day picked out, you're going to start a tiny little test fire in a corner.
Well, first, you want to wake up and have a complete breakfast.
Uh-huh.
Then you can go start your test fire.
Test fire, basically, you just look at it and say, how are you going to behave today?
Yeah. Well, even before you set the test fire, you want to plan out your area that you want to burn. And in the area, you want to identify natural fire breaks. These are things like roads, bodies of water, that kind of stuff. Things that the fire's not going to spread across, right?
Ideally, yeah.
And then you want to create even more fire breaks around it where there aren't natural ones. You want to plow and dig and cut and basically create an area to where the fire can't spread outside of the place you want to contain it into.
I wonder if dropping an atom bomb on a wildfire would work.
Operation Plowshare, sure.
I don't know.
I don't think so.
Probably not.
I think that would make everything a lot worse.
So once you've got all your fire breaks, both natural and the ones you've just made yourself with your hands, you want to start your first fire called the backfire.
Yeah.
And the backfire is downwind.
Yep.
It's against that fire break, so you know it's only going to be going in one direction. It's against the wind, so it's not going to be super fast.
Right.
And you're going to be able to control it. Like, you're kind of starting off nice and easy.
Yeah, just don't kill yourself out of the gate.
Yeah.
Just take it nice and easy, like you said.
Right.
Then after you got the backfire going, you create flank fires, one on each side, right?
Yep.
And they are not necessarily going against the wind, so they're going to burn a little bit faster.
Yeah, they're at right angles to the wind.
Right.
Yeah.
And one of the neat things about fire, when you're creating a controlled burn, is the places you're burning first actually create fire breaks themselves.
Yeah. Because
they burn the fuel. Have you ever seen The Gods Must Be Crazy 2?
Didn't see the second one.
There's like a bush fire, and I can't remember the main guy's name. He's awesome. He saves his like companions by setting fire to the grass around them.
Yeah.
So that the brush fire has nothing to burn when it gets to them. So he creates a fire break, basically, by burning the area around him before the fire gets there. So he controls it himself.
Was that good, the sequel?
Sure.
Yeah?
Yeah. Both of them are really good.
Man, I remember that when it came out. It was like kind of one of the first foreign sort of indie movies that made a big dust-up, I feel like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that got a lot of attention.
Mm-hmm. That's a good one.
Must be crazy.
Holds up.
Does it?
Yeah.
I'll have to check it out again. So where were we? We've got our flank fires. We've got our back fires. We're creating larger fire breaks.
Yeah.
And then you want to ignite the big daddy, the head fire.
Right.
Yes.
The head fire. It goes in the direction of the wind. It's upwind. So it blows very quickly downwind and spreads quick.
That's right.
But because you said it last, there's less fuel for it to burn. It's going to finish out the fire for you pretty quick.
Yeah.
But it's not going to go beyond the areas that have already been burned because you just created those fire breaks by burning them on the backfire and the flank fires.
Yeah.
So after that happens, your fire should be done. And you can go home. Just forget about it. After you set that head fire, just get in your truck and go home.
No, there's a little bit more. You got to stay there, my friend, until afterward. And then they call it mop-up duty. When you obviously put out all the flames completely with water, cut down any little trees that are on fire,
right,
and just extinguish everything and leave it a big smoldering nasty mess that is actually going to be good for the environment.
Yeah, and you got to tell everybody who drives by and shouts at you for setting a fire that you're doing this because it's better off in the long run.
Yeah.
Say the end justifies the means.
Pretty neat.
Yeah, another tip, don't wear rubber clothing when you're part of a fire-setting crew.
Yeah.
Because it can melt and stick to your skin.
I wonder, this is something I didn't look into. I wonder if the, surely they're just wildfire fighting teams that are doing this, right? It's the same people, right?
I would guess. I would hope. Because the thing is, it's like, yes, you can be told how to set a fire. I think that's probably the easy part. Like figuring out how to adjust when it starts to get out of control or doesn't do what you think it's going to do or the weather conditions change.
Or if it jumps that fire break that you think is big enough.
Right. That's when I think you need somebody who's like experienced.
Yeah, it's got to be firefighters.
Yeah, there should be the same people doing this who know what they're doing.
Yeah, I'm sure it is.
And if that's what you do, we want to hear from you. So shout out to us.
I think we heard from some fire jumpers. In the last episode.
We did from the wildfire one. And that was a good one, too. Go back and listen to that, everybody. Do it now. If you want to learn more about controlled burns, you can type those words in the search bar at HowStuffWorks.com. Since I said search bar, it's time for listener mail.
I'm going to call this mind blown. Not my mind. Listener's mind. Hey, guys. I was listening to the Landfills episode, and the most important issue you brought up is the song Powerhouse by the Raymond Scott Quintet. Josh had hummed a snippet, and Chuck said it was Looney Tunes. That was a moment of cognitive dissonance that rivaled almost anything I've suffered in my 41 years, because Josh was actually humming a bit of La Villa or La Via Strangiato by Rush, not some dumb 50s band. I know that song, so this caught my attention.
Powerhouse is from the 30s, and it was like an orchestral
piece. That's right.
Not a 50s band. This guy's out of his mind.
Well, yeah. Maybe so. I couldn't believe you were singing a part of one of my favorite songs by one of my favorite bands and crediting someone else. As I watched the Raymond Scott video, though, the universe refocused, like when the candle holder resolves into faces or the Canadian flag is irreversibly changed into two angry guys pressing their foreheads together.
Case closed.
Have you ever seen that? The Canadian flag?
No, I've seen one that says, like, Jesus loves you or something like that.
I never knew that the Canadian flag, if you look at it a certain way, looks like two guys. I went and looked, and, you know, sort of.
What about the man on the moon? You ever seen that?
I don't know.
Well, then you haven't.
Okay.
You would know.
We'll show it to you.
Yeah, it's kind of like, yeah, I guess I can see that.
It's like the arrow in the FedEx logo. Like, once you see it, you can't unsee it.
Unless you really want to, and then you can.
Oh, okay.
I don't see what this guy's talking about.
With a Canadian flag?
Yeah.
Well, you have to type in Canadian flag faces, and then someone will have... It's a bit of a stretch, if you ask me.
Have you ever seen any Sister Wendy stuff?
No.
She is a nun who just understands art and art history like no one else on the planet.
Yeah.
And she had like a PBS show for a little while, and she would just point out things in art that you just never think to look for.
Like in the negative space, like the illusion?
Sometimes, but also more like the shadows surrounding a family or something.
Oh, okay.
It makes them look isolated, and you're like, oh yeah, I didn't really put my finger on that or whatever.
Gotcha.
She's just got this really great knack for explaining art in really interesting ways. So, and I think it's online for free.
Alrighty.
Sorry about that.
No, that's all right. So, where are we? Canadian flag, two angry guys. Thanks for broadening my understanding of one of the first Rush songs I learned to play on drums. And then I found this on songfacts.com, and it sounds credible. Apparently, this was an issue, and Rush did not give credit to Scott for using Powerhouse. By the time Raymond Scott's publisher notified the band's management of the infringement, the statute of limitations had expired of the challenge. But Rush's management, out of deference to Mr. and Mrs. Scott, and being the class act that they are, offered a one-time penance payment, feeling it was the ethical thing to do. All involved were happy with the resolution, and Rush has no further financial obligations.
Wow.
Under
this
the settlement,
quite a story.
I know. Under the settlement, they were not required to accord Raymond Scott partial songwriting credit on the piece. So apparently, Powerhouse and Rush's La Villa Strangiata were similar, and they nicked it from there.
Huh.
Never knew.
I didn't either.
And that is from Ken Rinker in Colorado Springs.
Thanks a lot, Ken.
And he says best to Jerry in the game.
Jerry says thanks. I think. Yeah. Ken, that was awesome. I take back that you're out of your mind. You're interesting instead. How about that?
Yes.
If you want to get in touch with us, you can tweet to us at SYSK Podcast. You can join us on Instagram at SYSK Podcast too. You can join us on Facebook.com/StuffYouShouldKnow. You can send us an email to stuffpodcast@howstuffworks.com. And as always, join us at our home on the web, stuffyoushouldknow.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, if you haven't heard of Visible, well, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon as low as $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Use promo code STUFF20 to receive $20 off your first month for listening to this podcast. Switch now at visible.com. For data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com. The Visible monthly rate is $25 per month.
Childproofing people's homes is hard, but Duracell is making it just a bit simpler. Not only are they committed to educating parents, caregivers, and medical professionals about the importance of battery safety, they make the only lithium coin batteries with a non-toxic bitter coating to help discourage children from swallowing them. Duracell even features child-secure packaging designed to avoid accidental opening. Learn more at Duracell.com/power safely. Available on 2032, 2025, and 2016 sizes.